Support for The Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management, a career for people, planet, and profit from UW-Parkside, in partnership with UW Extension. More information is available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are very honored and pleased that we can have with us on the Morning Show for this 20th of January, Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, Director of the Clawson Center, author of After the Cold War, a columnist whose work appears in newspapers all across the country and outside of our borders, for that matter. And Dr. Sear is actually our single most frequent Morning Show guest, and we always feel honored to have him aboard to offer his perspective on various things going on in our country and in our world. And there are plenty of things going on in our country right now, of course. So I'm really exceptionally grateful to have this opportunity to speak with Professor Sear. Happy New Year, Dr. Art Sear, and welcome back to the Morning Show.
Well, Happy New Year to you, Greg, and thank you for the kind invitation. You're always so gracious. It's a real tonic in the morning.
Glad to be speaking with you. So your most recent column spoke of the shocking events. You used the word shocking to describe what unfolded in our nation's capital on Wednesday, January 6th, 2 weeks ago, as people are listening to this this Morning Show conversation. First of all, I wonder if, on a somewhat personal note, if we could hear what your own sort of personal, visceral reaction was to what unfolded on that day, and to what extent were you completely surprised? Did you think this was completely unexpected, or in a sense, in some ways, inevitable, or some mix of the two?
Well, I guess I wasn't surprised, given the way we live and the way the summer unfolded, with lots of demonstrations and lots of violent activity, by no means all of it from the far right or from Trump supporters, as you well know, sir, and our listeners do too. I was surprised that they were able to penetrate, the rioters were able to penetrate the Capitol. I'm very sad, as is everyone, or everyone should be, about the loss of life. The five people who were killed, and there have been at least one ancillary death that may be related to that. I was kind of surprised that they penetrated the Capitol. For a long time, I haven't been to Washington for a while, partly because of the pandemic. For a long time after 9/11, you saw tremendous security, especially around principal government buildings, including heavy concrete caissons and lots of police presence. And apparently we became complacent, which is too bad, obviously, with 2020 hindsight.
One of the things that you say in your column, not mincing words whatsoever, is there can be no serious doubt that President Trump incited the riot. What led you to say that statement, and as plainly as you did?
Well, my statement echoes broad media commentary, especially in mainstream media, and especially from you and your colleagues in public radio and television. That I agree, the president's incendiary rhetoric incited this, and it's a good argument for a return to tradition in terms of exercising restraint and choosing your words carefully if you're fortunate enough and also powerful enough to be president of the United States.
One word of, I don't know that it's exactly reassurance, maybe it is that in that column you wrote, this violent spectacle is neither unique nor a sign that our government institutions face fundamental threat to their existence. And in that respect, you're probably not in full alignment with at least some in the media who have painted it in darker terms. I'd be very curious to know exactly where you're coming from in terms of offering that word of clarification or reassurance.
Our system survives. It was a one-time event in terms of attacking the Capitol building, and despite the physical violence and all the turmoil, including lots of media turmoil and efforts to whip up concern by various media personalities and outlets, the Electoral College vote was confirmed, and the system did work despite this violent incident.
When I read your words, I was reminded of a governor, and I don't remember who it is now, but I saw her on television not long after, I believe it was the Three Mile Island nuclear accident. And this governor, who had tended to be fairly positive when it comes to nuclear energy, in trying to put that incident in perspective, said what people are forgetting is these various safeguards for this kind of event, they did work. Yes, it was a frightening incident, but the safeguards did what they were supposed to do. And I mean, not that all harm was completely prevented, but in a sense, the one truth sort of blotted out the other. And I think you're trying to say something a bit similar, that in some ways this was a test. And it was a frightening test, but it's one that you think our fundamental institutions survived, which is something we should not be overlooking.
That's a very imaginative analogy. Three Mile Island, I believe your reference, for those who might not be so well informed as you, is to a nuclear meltdown that occurred at a nuclear reactor back in the 1970s, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you brought it up.
I mean, I don't remember the decade. It's many, many years ago. But
scientific disaster. It was contained. I don't know, how do we relate this in realistic terms, a scientific occurrence with the very human violence that we saw in Washington? Well, the Soviet Union, much later on, not long before the collapse of unattractive and rather evil system, had a similar nuclear accident at Chernobyl. They covered it up. A lot of people were killed. It was a truly physical disaster that went well beyond Three Mile Island. That gets, I think, thinking out loud, is, since you brought it up, that gets at a fundamental strength of a free system, easy to overlook because we are a democracy is by definition disorderly, and we have a lot of different interests at play in this very diverse country, especially. But we're able to handle things better, actually, than a dictatorship. Fortunately, the Soviet dictatorship, a particularly evil system, is gone, in effect, despite the lesser evils of contemporary Russia. We're actually better suited, for lots of complicated reasons, to handle natural disasters. Interesting, you brought up Three Mile Island. I never would have thought of that analogy.
Well, the connection that I draw is something really frightening that was a very scary test. And when you, in a sense, pass a test, there should be some measure of relief. And so we should all, as Americans, feel some relief that despite this terrible threat to this fundamental process, that process did go forward with those those men and women on Capitol Hill courageously stepping forward and continuing the process despite what they had just experienced. And so that is something to celebrate on a otherwise really dark day.
Yes, quite right. I never would have thought of that analogy. It's always very interesting being on your program.
So something else you said in that column, I think, is really important. When you think back to what happened on January 6th and the perpetrators of that attempted insurrection, you write at one point that one of the kind of scary realities of the current day is that criminals can shelter in the extremes of the political spectrum. I want to read that again. Criminals can shelter in the extremes of the political spectrum. What are you getting at there?
Well, just pointing out reality that we've had a lot of violent crime this year that's a function of different things, including the basic fact of life that people are cooped up in unusual and abnormal ways. If you decide to riot, you can take shelter. You can take shelter beneath the rationale, not justification, but rationale of the far right or the far left. Mind you, President Trump was quick to denounce the rioting that occurred, and he may even be sincere about that, but the fact remains that his rhetoric encouraged that, and criminals at both ends of the political spectrum, at least in terms of the rationale and justification they're seeking in public, can use the political system up to a point, but we do have the rule of law, and I think one of the positive things, I hope, one of the positive things resulting from the shocking and violent and lethal riot in Washington was that public officials at the state and local government from both parties around the country will be a lot more active and a lot more proactive in using the law and law enforcement to put down the civil unrest.
You pointed out something in this column that I'm not sure I had actually heard of, or I think I heard about it, but did not, in a sense, realize its significance. This is when you tell the reader about a document that was created and signed by, I believe, all living former U.S. defense secretaries, a letter directed to President Trump and or his closest advisors. First of all, can you remind our listeners about this and maybe underscore for us why you thought this was something pretty momentous?
Well, it was an important public event. Dick Cheney, I don't think it was momentous. It was noteworthy, especially because of the tremendous alarm and concern nonstop since the election by a lot of our media that President Trump might do something extreme, such as using the military to stay in power. I was responding to that. There's no evidence that the president has done that, but like a lot of news nowadays, I wouldn't use the term fake news, but it's speculation in the media, alarmism in the media. And Dick Cheney, to his credit, who was Secretary of Defense in the George H.W. Bush administration, during the first Gulf War, when he and President Bush and Colin Powell, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs at the time, I believe, carried out the first Gulf War, the UN-sanctioned and U.S.-led liberation of Kuwait from occupation by the armed forces from Iraq. The former defense secretary, as well as vice president, lined up all, rather quickly, I think, all the living former secretaries of defense, underscoring the importance of the rule of law and the fact that no president has the right to use the military arbitrarily in this country. That's all. It was momentous only in the sense that this is something that the media has whipped up, that politicians have exploited on the other side. Trump himself, as we're recording this, he's got one more day in office. There's no indication that he's going to be trying to use the military. If he did, he'd fail. It's an illegal order to seize control of the levers of power. It's inspired by the fact that in other countries, not just in poor areas of the world, that's often the default position for a leader who's under threat, or the military itself will take over. That's very contrary to the American tradition, and our listeners should be reassured by the fact that for all the terrible news and all the scary speculation in our 24/7 news cycle nowadays, we have the rule of law and a very stable system.
I guess what struck me as momentous is that all of the living former U.S. defense secretaries would deem it necessary or advisable to craft such a document. I mean, which in a sense says something that goes without saying, except in this instance, they seem to have thought that this needed to be stated categorically. I mean, that seems at least unprecedented, if not momentous.
Unprecedented, perhaps. It shows the momentous influence of the media rather than anything the president has actually done so far.
Right.
Yeah, it shows how important the media is in raising concern, raising alarm, and going beyond the facts into speculation. An awful lot of the news nowadays with our 24/7 cycle is endless speculation and entertainment.
So are you saying that the defense...
Not reporting the facts, excuse me.
So are you saying that the defense secretaries did that simply to calm the American public?
You would have to ask Dick Cheney and his senior colleagues in putting up and putting together the letter. I don't speak for anybody but myself.
Right.
I think I would guess calming the public was certainly one motivation, along with reminding the president that his power is limited and we have the rule of law. I think it was a good move. I don't think it was self-serving. I think it was a good move, which is how very quickly, apparently, one former defense secretary was able to line up all his colleagues.
Right. I guess what I'm speculating then is...
Yes, you are. Absolutely. Yeah. Speculating. And that's the nature of your program. My point was about, quote, news, unquote, programs that have very little factual information, but fill up the time.
Right.
Fill up the air time with a lot of hot air. And mostly entertainment and speculation, a development that began in the 1980s. With the abolition by the Reagan administration of the Fairness Doctrine, and a practical reaction to the fact that the old, traditional, very limited, several national news networks, ABC, NBC, and especially CBS, and also PBS, at that point well-established, the public broadcasting system, were being replaced by a lot of different cable organizations, and they were anxious to have the freedom to go beyond federal restrictions and how the news is reported and discussed. Really important, and not much discussed in the media. I'm really glad you brought it up. Thank you.
We're speaking with Dr. Art Seer-Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, paying his first visit to the morning show in 2021. In another recent column, you in a sense contrast this stormy departure by outgoing President Donald Trump to the rather low-key entrance of Joe Biden as our president-elect to be inaugurated later today. Although this column dates back to, I think, December, but after his victory. But at more than one point in that column, you used the word low-key to describe the way President-elect Biden was kind of putting things together and moving forward as president-elect. In what respects has he used a low-key approach, and in what way do you think that's perhaps been helpful at this point in time?
He ran a campaign that did not involve the usual excitement of a campaign. Age may have something to do with it. He is our oldest inaugurated president. But beyond that, I don't think he's lost that much energy since his very energetic 2012 vice presidential reelection campaign, when he was highly visible, highly active. Critics would say he served as a hatchet man for President Obama and the administration. he certainly was a very, very aggressive opponent of the Republican vice presidential nominee, Paul Ryan. It's a change in style that I'm sure was calculated. I thought it seemed surprising to me, and I thought he might be in some trouble because he wasn't running a more aggressive, more colorful campaign, but that just is a reminder to me that I'm a professor sitting on the sidelines. The campaign worked, and he did win, and he won by a significant margin.
In that column, you mention a couple of his first cabinet appointments, Anthony Blinken for Secretary of State and Janet Yellen to be Secretary of the Treasury. And of course, he's announced many other nominations since then. Do you have any kind of general feelings about the kind of team that he appears to be assembling for his upcoming administration?
Yeah, they're like himself. They tend to be Washington pros, several of them, including the Secretary of State, Secretary of the Treasury, and National Security Advisor. In particular, people he's worked with pretty closely over the years, not just during the Obama administration. In that sense, Trump supporters will say that just underscores the fact that the swamp is back, or the established order that President Trump ran against is back in power. I think one reason why the low-key campaign worked so well is because it was such a contrast with Trump, who's constantly in the limelight, constantly in the media, can't stop tweeting, can't keep quiet for any length of time. A couple of the president's supporters with whom I'm acquainted, I'm certainly not a supporter of President Trump's, have said he can't get out of his own way. He's his own worst enemy. The Wall Street Journal, which at times on policy terms has been sympathetic to the Trump administration, quite rightly from their point of view, they've been very stridently and strongly and effectively critical of Trump's overblown and bombastic style.
I wonder if you were surprised at the moves that were made that, for instance, banned the president indefinitely from Twitter and other major social media platforms that, to some extent at least, have silenced outgoing President Trump. Did you foresee that was going to happen, or did that come as a surprise?
No, I did not foresee that he'd be banned from Twitter.
Some people are playing that up as George Orwell 1984, that it is suppression of free speech and so on. Do you think do we need to ask some questions about what those kind of decisions mean?
Congress is asking questions. Another example, to my mind, of the system working. There is movement, and I think that will increase now that the Democrats have control of both houses of Congress. And since it was a Republican president, I think there may well be some Republican sympathy with efforts to apply antitrust law to these huge media companies. I think that's a very healthy sign. They have de facto monopolies, not de jure monopolies. I think it's a good opportunity for other entrepreneurs to come onto the scene. And I think it'll be very interesting to see how much real competition there is to dominant engines and dominant corporations like Twitter, Google.
If you were in a position to advise our next president, Joe Biden, what would your advice to him be?
To be himself. In politics, you're torn and pulled in endless different directions. He's a great survivor. He's certainly very durable. I met him at least twice. I worked for 2 decades at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. Learned a lot. I'm very proud of what John Riley, the longtime president, he was there for 30 years. Quite an extraordinary run as head of any kind of nonprofit, educational, any institution, especially in the public arena. He had been Hubert Humphrey's foreign policy assistant back in the 1960s. Humphrey was a very successful senator, someone I've admired most of my life. He was a close ally of President Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson's in the Senate, in getting the very ambitious legislative program of that era through, especially after President Johnson tragically became president as a result of the Dallas assassination. Then Humphrey was Johnson's vice president, was almost elected president in 1968. John was hired in Chicago in part because of his extensive Washington contacts. Joe Biden was elected to the Senate, very possibly the youngest in history, when he was around 30 in 1972. And senators, congressmen, Washington officials of that time, we had the contacts to bring them to Chicago. I was impressed. I used to tell our very fine staff at the council that, remember, in this business, we deal with the great, the near great, and the end great, the passing parade of egos, and people who were quite important and people who thought they were important. It could be a bit, it could be a bit wearing over time. Joe Biden is a very authentic person. One thing that really struck me is his staff really likes him, which is not always the case in any organization, and especially in Washington, among Washington types. I concluded early on that means a lot. He's very easy to deal with. He is quite loquacious, and was even more so then, probably. John was fanatic about balanced budgets and effective operation. He was a successful executive. We never had a deficit, and we kept the budget growing in real terms, and that was the era of stagflation, and life was tough. He was a fanatic about time as well, and I have one clear memory of John Reilly saying about 9:05 as we were concluding a dinner to Senator Biden, "Well, we have time for one more question." And I kid you not, at 9:20, 9:25, Joe was still talking. Like Hubert Humphrey and others, he just could not shut himself up. So we'll see how the discipline of the presidency affects him. But I was impressed by him. He's likable, he's authentic, and smart. He's very, very smart, a quick-witted person. It's not always the case, even with people who've amassed considerable political success and power.
Let's talk about somebody else whom you wrote about recently, namely Vladimir Putin.
Not so nice, no. Yeah.
Right.
Also smart, however.
Yeah. You wrote back about a press conference that occurred back on December 19th, and you say the main news is that there was none, save for coy hints that he may change the Constitution to remain in office beyond 2024. So that is an interesting prospect. But from there, you really go on to kind of explore the question of how nervous should we be about Russia, and what kind of a player are they on the world scene? And among the points that you make in this column is that Russia is probably a lot more nervous about us and others than we are about them. I mean, that there is a certain fragility to their place in the world. I mean, even though none of us would probably use the word fragility to describe Vladimir Putin. But what do you want us to understand about Russia and our relationship to them at this point in time?
Russia is a very weak country economically. In fact, they were literally about to collapse in terms of the structure of the economy when he achieved national power right around the turn of the century. And through skillful management, taking maximum advantage of their natural resources, especially petroleum, but there are others as well. He was able to engineer recovery, and he's been able to operate largely behind the scenes in a way that has permitted him to maintain control, obviously, while facilitating within limits, while facilitating business development. It's quite a performance. His press conference, this is an annual event that's become now a tradition. It's invariably interesting. He went on for 4.5 hours. He's almost 70. It's a testament to his energy and personal discipline, I think, and his intelligence. You answered a wide range of questions, unlike the orchestrated media events in that dictatorship during the rest of the year involving Putin. The international media was present. It was not a rehearsed exercise, and at least in terms of a portion of the people who were there. And he acquitted himself very well. He's extremely intelligent, despite the fact that they operate on a weak base in total contrast to the United States of America. He and the clique around him have been able to exercise, I think, remarkable international influence, especially in the Middle East. Trump and associates, including his son-in-law, do deserve some credit for brokering diplomatic recognition agreements between Israel and the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman, increasing Israel's security in the region. I believe that is a major step forward, building on the Egypt and Jordan peace treaties that were initiated by President Carter a long time ago. But basically, Russia is the most important outside player in the Middle East today, especially but not exclusively regarding Syria. The Russians have been able to work out a de facto, meaning Putin, modus vivendi, at least, with Netanyahu and associates in the government of Israel, just extraordinary. At the end, I referred to George H.W. Bush and associates who prosecuted the remarkably successful Gulf War 1990-91. Afterwards, they didn't rest on their victory, but Bush and Secretary of State James Baker especially engaged the most extraordinary, exhausting, especially for Baker, diplomacy. Baker made something like 6 trips to the Middle East from Washington during the first few months of 1991 after the Allied victory in the war, organized and orchestrated a major peace conference in Madrid. The limited sovereignty of a Palestinian state as a direct result of that process. The U.S. Was the dominant international player in the Middle East for the first time since the since Eisenhower's first term way back in the 1950s. All of that has been frittered away by successor administrations. The final peace treaty was at an Oslo conference at the beginning of the Clinton administration. That's how long it took. And Bill Clinton was there to take credit, but Clinton, Bush, Obama, I think we've had a steady fading of serious U.S. foreign policy and the kind of literally exhausting disciplined effort that's required. And Russia has replaced us. It shows just how, along with personal survival in a truly dangerous environment, it shows just how effective Putin is. It's a reminder to us that the world remains a dangerous place. Rhetoric, right. PR, media activity is no substitute for real hard foreign policy work.
Right. You write at one point, our greatest danger is our own lack of serious leadership. And you're talking especially, of course, about the landscape of the Middle East. I want to also take a couple of minutes to talk about Brexit, which you wrote about recently, telling us that at the end of this month, it was a year ago, actually, wasn't it? At the end of January 2020.
It's been going on forever.
Right, yeah. The United Kingdom formally departed from the European Union, but then the matter of kind of hammering out the details of that has proven to be really, really difficult. One of the things you said was that Theresa May, who of course had perpetual struggles as prime minister, she actually worked really hard in what you say was a very businesslike fashion to try to hammer out some of the details of Brexit, all to no avail. And now her successor, Boris Johnson, who couldn't be more different in terms of personality and approach, has in a sense been entrusted with the same assignment. So tell us where all of this has ultimately gone.
Well, Britain has left the European Union in a what I would see is a kind of breezy seat of the pants fashion. Let's leave the details till later. Let's all make general statements together and have media opportunities, and then we'll let the civil servants and others take care of the details. Theresa May, to her personal credit, she didn't last long as prime minister, worked out three very detailed agreements with the bureaucrats in Brussels, who administer the European Union, and all three were voted down by parliament, and a lot of people in her own conservative party participated in voting her down, and she was gone. Last January, breezy Boris Johnson got a very general agreement with Brussels. He literally flew there. It was a very short meeting, flew back. The details will be worked out during the year. And civil servants on both sides have worked doggedly. Like a lot of politicians, it wasn't until the last minute, literally, as the year was almost up, that Boris Johnson and his senior political associates really got engaged. And they did work out a deal with the European Union. There are two, so Britain is out, and we'll see how Britain does. I think the industrial economies, especially in the West, are wealthy enough, and our international economy is secure enough that certainly Britain will survive. They're the number five economy in the world, and that will probably continue. They are a truly international trading nation and investment nation. But since World War II, Britain's investment and heavy trade, especially heavy trade, has been more and more concentrated in the continent. And they will have a major challenge in terms of adjusting to what will be new barriers for goods. There won't be tariffs, but customs, other kinds of technical regulations are guaranteed to complicate trade with the continent.
You mentioned in this column that one of the sticking points in these negotiations over Brexit was fishing rights, of all things. And it sounds like there are sort of big reasons just beneath the surface that made fishing rights such a challenging point to overcome. Can you explain that?
It's not a subject I'm an expert on, and fortunately don't have to become an expert on. The ins and outs of trade and finance and investment in the European Union and travel, but agricultural interests tend to be powerful in every country. And that's certainly true in Britain. There's also nationalism involved. We don't want these foreigners in our waters. And the east of the British Isles, the fishing grounds are rich enough that there are opportunities for conflict. But it became a kind of symbol of our need to get away from Europe. And so lots of emotion, I think, was involved along with the specifics of how much should we be compensated when fishing boats from other countries are in or near our waters. Agriculture, the farmers are powerful in every country, including the United States, to a remarkable degree, given they're a shrinking percentage of industrial nation populations.
I also appreciated in this column that you brought up a name that I haven't thought of in the longest time, former Prime Minister Edward Heath. And I think you would probably characterize him as, in a sense, kind of an unsung hero and unjustly forgotten figure of importance in all this.
He was done in by the very powerful labor unions in Britain, especially the miners, and a miners' strike that was extremely painful, literally, for the British during a cold winter, was really crucial to doing in his government. Polls in 1970 showed that the Labor Party, government led by Harold Wilson, was going to return to office yet again after they'd won in 64 just barely, and then in 66 more decisively. And there was a surprise victory, and Heath came in. Traditionally, aristocrats are very, very talented, not non-aristocrats. Benjamin Disraeli, the great 19th century prime minister, big rival of Gladstone, the liberal leader, is a dramatic contrary example. But certainly into the 1960s, aristocrats were in charge of the Conservative Party. Slowly, in a complicated way, became more open and more democratic. Both Heath and Margaret Thatcher were from relatively modest backgrounds. And I think he may have suffered personally as a result of the fact that he was such a path-breaking figure. He was never really part of the establishment, and he didn't have the policy success ultimately that Margaret Thatcher had, and he didn't have the colorful, domineering personality that she had. I met him once when I was a graduate student. I don't want to keep bringing up personal encounters here, but I was very fortunate to spend a year in England when I was a graduate student working on my PhD dissertation. The British tend to be very generous and humane, especially where Americans are concerned. And an American student easily got access to the three-party conferences. I was working on the third party, the Liberals, not the Liberal Democrats. And I met him in a receiving line at the Tory conference. He was literally an extremely stiff person. People tend to make fun of that. He had a bone-crushing handshake. It was an interesting encounter, not a typical politician. He seemed to be a very shy man, and I was a very shy graduate student. He finally, after my hand recovered, he said, "Who are you?" And I said, he said, "Who are you? Where are you from?" And I said, "Well, I'm a graduate student. I'm working with Sam Beer at Harvard." And he said, "How is Sam?" So that gave us something to talk about briefly. I met Margaret Thatcher as well. The Liberals weren't getting a lot of attention. And as I say, our British friends, there really is a special relationship. Unlike the rest of Europe, which the British aren't so warm about historically or currently. I was having lunch with a Liberal MP, member of parliament, in their cafeteria. And a young conservative politician by the name of Margaret Thatcher was walking by, and he wanted to introduce me to her, so he got up. Another bone-crushing handshake. We've all encountered the tiresome alpha male who turns a handshake into an arm wrestling contest, but Margaret Thatcher is the one woman I've, in my life, shaken hands with who had the same problem. She immediately turned it into it. And I was, since it was a female, I was totally surprised, and it really hurt. I believe my knees buckled slightly, and she seemed to have a faint smile, and she noticed my distress. My two prime minister stories involving handshakes. She was long before she became prime minister, but she was already a rising star in the Conservative Party, and she was, of course, the first female prime minister in Britain, and we followed their lead in lots of positive ways. I'm sure we'll have a woman president sooner rather than later in this country. Not necessarily Kamala Harris, let me add.
Right. Well, on that note, I appreciate all that you've shared with us, including the illuminating personal anecdotes and your thoughts on matters both here and abroad in these very, very interesting times in which we live. Dr. Art Seer-Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business. It's always a pleasure, sir. I look forward to our next visit very much. Thanks for being part of the morning show today.
Professor Berg, likewise, you're always very gracious, and it's always enjoyable as well as interesting. Thank you.
And the time is 8:54 on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. We're going to finish out the hour, actually, with some music of American composer Aaron Copland on this inauguration day. And we're going to be listening to the stirring music that opens the fourth movement of his third symphony, music which is affectionately known as the Fanfare for the Common Man. This was actually written originally as a freestanding fanfare for wind orchestra, and then a few years later adapted by Mr. Copland as the opening theme of that final movement to his stirring Third Symphony. And this will be the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, and Yoel Levy is the conductor. So, music of Aaron Copland as we listen to this fanfare for the common man.
Thank you.
Aaron Copland's fanfare for the common man, as heard in the opening to the final movement of his Third Symphony. 8:58 the time here on WGTD. Tomorrow on the morning show, we're going to be hearing from the author of a brand new thriller called Animal, which explores, among other things, the important theme of animal cruelty and tells the story of a vigilante who is determined to avenge animals all around the world who have been mistreated in one way or another. A very, very intriguing book and intriguing story. On Friday, Fawn Germer, the author of How to Win the Job You Want When You've Lost the Job You Need, which focuses very specifically on people in mid to late professional life when they have found themselves displaced from their job and how they can make themselves relevant and attractive in a tight job market. A very interesting and potentially helpful book. Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management, a career for people, planet, and profit from UW-Parkside in partnership with UW Extension. Details available at uwp.edu. It's exactly 9 o'clock.